right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, all you wonderful citizens of Crypt Nation. I hope you guys are having a fantastic morning, noon, or night, wherever you guys are in the world. You are certainly in the right place because you're back. You're joining us for another high caliber, action packed episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce, as always, joined by my notorious compadre, Mr. Brendan Veman, reigning from the great state of Florida. How are you doing, Brendan?
Bryce, doing fantastic, right? When you're in the crypto markets, it's hard to be doing bad, especially this time of year. We just had the halving. There's so much going on, a lot to be excited about. So all things are well from my end.
Absolutely. All things are good. You know, it's a nice, we're getting nice springtime weather all across the country. And man, we are so excited to be bringing on a Bitcoin mining expert, Rob Chang. And Rob Chang is the CEO of Griffin Digital Mining. So Rob, thank you for joining us today. And how are you doing?
Thanks for having me, and doing great.
Well, hey, we're really excited to dive into, you know, especially since this is being recorded so close to the halving. We're excited to dive into the dynamics there, how that's affecting Bitcoin mining and crypto more broadly. But before we dive into all that stuff, we just want to catch up with you. Give us a little background so that our audience has some context on who you are and what is the very special, very interesting, publicly traded company that you're running.
Have you ever wanted to trade Bitcoin but haven't dared tried? With Plus 500 Futures, you can trade crypto without the hassle of opening a wallet. With just a few clicks, you can register and start practicing with their free and unlimited demo. See a trading opportunity? You'll be able to trade in just two clicks. Feel ready? You can move to real money with as little as $100 once your account is approved. And the great thing is that in addition to crypto, Plus 500 gives you access to a wide range of instruments like the S&P 500, NASDAQ, gas, and much more. Explore equity indices like energy, metals, Forex, and beyond. With a simple and intuitive platform, you can trade anytime, anywhere. Experience the fast, accessible futures trading you've been waiting for with Plus 500. With over 20 years of experience, Plus 500 is your gateway to the markets. Visit us.plus500.com to learn more. Trading in futures involves risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone. Not all applicants will qualify, and this is not personal financial advice. Plus 500, it's trading with a plus.
Yeah, so thanks for the opportunity. Rob Chang, I'm the current CEO, president, and director of Griffin Digital Mining. I guess let's start from the background. For myself, I was 15 some odd years in the investment banking research world. So was doing the investment banking thing. Was head of metals and mining of research for Cantor Fitzgerald, so traditional mining. And so I think I'm one of the few people who've done the dirty mining with the stuff coming out of the ground. Now the cleaner version, we're using machines. And quite frankly, this is much better and much more fun for me. But they do the commodity thing for quite a while. I think Bloomberg named me the top precious metals analyst in Q1 2016. And I was more well known uranium back there. And so actually for the uranium, since leaving, I'm actually on the board of a couple of uranium companies. Which really helps on our ESG clean energy mandate because it helps me understand the business. But the point being is that I came from a commodity background, which really helps run a Bitcoin miner because I do believe Bitcoin is a commodity. And so we've been running Griffin as a commodity company. But story of how I moved over, which some people might find interesting, was in 2017, I looked at one of my clients' portfolios and I found that they had a 1% allocation in Bitcoin. And this very respected guy based out of London, I asked him, like, why do you have that? You have gold, precious metals, all the other things. And he told me he just really believes in the space. Caused me to do a deep dive into Bitcoin blockchain, realized this was going to change the world. And I promised myself when I was teenage, Rob, when the internet happened, that the next time something world-changing like the internet happens, drop everything, do that. A couple of reasons. One is you get to do some really cool stuff when you're at the forefront of a new emerging thing like that. And secondly, and a little more selfishly, I found that anyone who was with a reasonably good company in the beginning of the internet usually ended up doing pretty well for themselves economically. So I thought, well, get to do fun stuff and do well. Why not? So looked around, ended up that one of my other investors that I worked with was behind Riot, blockchain then, platforms now, and they were looking for a CFO. This was 2018. And so flew down to Florida and got the job on the spot and switched careers. And so became the CFO of Riot, which is the first publicly traded Bitcoin miner on the NASDAQ, as many people know, and parachuted on the top of the hill. It's the largest company for a while, still is among the top four. And at the time, things were not as rosy as people kind of see things now, where being first is always more difficult. The SEC didn't like us, still kind of doesn't like the space, but that's another conversation. There's that. There was a declining Bitcoin price, so I had to manage that company for a bit and kept it afloat because it was tough at that time. Moved on to do some other consulting work because I wanted to become the CEO somewhere instead of being a CFO. Did a brief stop over at Hive and helped those great people over there help run their company. And then I ran a group run to a group of people who had a vision of running a Bitcoin miner exactly the same way I did. And that's what I was thinking as I was going through my Bitcoin mining career, is that if I got to do this from scratch, there are certain mistakes, in my opinion, that I could fix and just do it better. And so jumped at the opportunity, created Griffin. And really, the proof is in the pudding. Griffin has been a private company for 3 years. We recently got listed on the NASDAQ in February. So we've been around for about 2 to 3 months now as a pubco. But as a private mining company, we've actually been outperforming the industry pretty substantially. For example, Bitcoin efficiency, which is a measure of how well an operation runs and generally accepted as the best measure. When we compare our Bitcoin efficiency relative to everyone that publicly discloses, we're in the top three. We are number one 2/3 of the time, and we have not fallen out of the top three except one time where it was a weird tie situation, which put us fourth. And so we've generally been one of the top performers in Bitcoin efficiency and generally number one. And we're also one of the lowest cost producers. Like last year, we produced Bitcoin at $18,200 per Bitcoin, which is among the lowest that we're aware of. So very happy to be part of the show. And that's kind of myself and Griffin in a quick nutshell, but there's certainly a lot more to talk about.
Yeah, I love that you have this background in both like traditional mining of metals, and now you have the experience mining digital assets and cryptocurrency. And we see a lot of like love and camaraderie and appreciation between the metals and the cryptocurrency space. Like you look at a lot of metal providers, if you want to buy online, they accept cryptocurrency. And you know, Bitcoin's commonly referred to as the digital gold. And I think that's a big reason for it. I think that there's a lot of relatability between the two spaces, maybe factoring out Peter Schiff. but besides that, you know, did anything translate over from like the physical process of mining like true metals versus the digital mining process of cryptocurrencies?
Absolutely, because I believe that Bitcoin is basically another commodity. And the best way to operate as a producer, really miner, in either of those industries is be the low-cost provider, because we can't control the price of our product. That's the market. And that's the same for gold, uranium, copper, Bitcoin. And so we can't control that. So the only way to make a viable company is to be cost-effective. And so that's being as efficient as possible and being as low-cost as possible. So avoiding company bloat. Like there are many Bitcoin miners out there that are quite large, and it's a product of their success for sure. But that's just a standard thing. As you get bigger, you just have a tendency to hire more. You have larger budgets. You start spending on more things that probably isn't necessary. And then when downturns happen, that's when you get bitten. And so those who are familiar with the commodity industry and are experienced in it generally try to keep costs low at all times. You know, take the profits when you get them and be prepared for periods where you're probably not making much or maybe even losing money waiting for the next upcycle. And so that approach is a commodity specific approach and something that we adopted at Griffin, and is one of the reasons why we're leading in efficiency and among one of the lowest cost producers.
I love it. And so coming from a guy who was, you know, a commodities expert, one of the top analysts in the world, and you take a look at, you know, gold, it has utility across industries and uranium and all these precious metals and the rare earth metals and stuff. So people think, okay, there's commodities. You could price them based on maybe how they're going to be used and all that kind of stuff. And then I hear a lot of people say, well, how could Bitcoin be a commodity? You know, what is it used for in industry? So what is, you know, how do you classify Bitcoin as a commodity? And it's not just you, by the way, the CFTC, which is the Commodities Future Trading Commission, also classifies Bitcoin as a commodity. So like, help us understand what the hallmarks of a digital commodity really is.
Yeah, great question. And it really acts like digital gold because it is a store of value. There are many people buying Bitcoin as an investment, as an anti-US dollar or a hedge against the US dollar in inflation that occurs, or really any currency's inflation. So it shares a lot of qualities with gold, and that's probably the reason why it is called digital gold by many. It is fungible. People are buying and selling and making transactions using Bitcoin. I have this great example. Use case actually where when in one of my prior lives I was buying machines out of China, and we sent a wire transfer of a few 6 digits of value, and a week later it still didn't go through. We checked through the system and found out that one of the intermediary banks in between stopped it for some reason, didn't tell us, and just reversed it out. And so we didn't know until we investigated. We canceled all of that, sent Bitcoin, and within 30 minutes, it was transacted at pennies on the dollar in cost. Right. So stuff like that is very useful. And there is use in the value transfer of Bitcoin. We're seeing more and more of that. So it really is operating just like a commodity because it is supply and demand. There are ebbs and flows just like in any commodity cycle. And frankly, mining companies in the space need to operate as if this is a commodity as opposed to just something to hop in and pump the stock price. Because if you want a long-term viable company, you need to control costs.
And I guess from one, just to extend this analogy a little bit. So when, you know, gold, and I actually don't know how the supply chain works. I'm just kind of assuming, but I assume like gold miners, they mine this gold and they sell it to somebody who wants to use it, whether it's Apple who wants to, you know, use it in their phones or a jeweler who wants to use it in the jewelry. Yes. Who buys Bitcoin from you, from Bitcoin miners? Like you guys are supplying the market. Are you guys just selling it on the exchange or is there a certain counterparty that typically is buying Bitcoin from you that you mine?
We sell it on an exchange because it's just the most efficient way to do so. If someone is willing to establish a relationship with us to buy our Bitcoin directly, and I think there is value in that, given that we are 100% renewable. So it is a carbon neutral Bitcoin. So anyone who wants to accumulate those would certainly be interested in buying ours because it's certified to be buying that. But right now we've just been using the easiest form of market, lowest cost, and just selling it into the exchange. And to answer the question that you were earlier asking, the people buying it, not really sure exactly what they're doing with it, but generally I think it falls into two buckets. They're either a hodler who believes in the space and is just accumulating Bitcoin because they believe it would be worth more, or at least is a hedge against the inflation. Yeah. And the other is using it for transactions, right? We see people doing that and buying and selling things. It's small, but increasing. And certainly seeing that being used as well.
You know, I got a twofold question in response to that. Number one, like, how do you determine when to sell? Does that have to do with what the cost of mining Bitcoin is? Maybe there's a ratio that you have where if it's like, hey, the cost to mine Bitcoin is, you know, $50,000. If it's 1.5 times that ratio, so we get up to 75,000, are you then like selling above that point? I'm just curious, like what goes into the process of determining when a miner like yourself sells? And I guess the second part of this question, which we can dive into after, is, you know, when the cost of mining Bitcoin, which again is adjusted every halving, when it gets below that cost of mining a Bitcoin, is that an area where you personally look at and you're like, all right, I'm going to leave my miners on. I'm going to turn them off. Yeah. I'm going to be mining above break even price below. What does your process look like when you're like teetering on that line?
Great question. And surprisingly, I think you're one of the first people to ever ask the second question, which is a little shocking now that I think about it.
Yeah, I was going to think it out.
So I know it's actually odd that no one's ever asked that specific question, which I think is weird. But let's tackle the first part first, which is how do we decide to sell? For us, it's actually fairly simple. And it opens a can of worms on another question, which I'm going to dive into. So please bear with me as I do it. But to answer your question originally, simple. For us, it is we have US dollar costs because we're a US operation. And so we will always sell enough Bitcoin to cover costs. We think it is improper to raise equity to pay for costs when you're generating revenue through Bitcoin. Because we do, I think some of my peers believe in the HODL strategy, and that's the rabbit hole I want to dive into in a moment, where they'll just hold all the Bitcoin and find money in other ways to pay their operations. We don't do that. And that's from my commodity background. If I generate revenue a certain way, I should certainly be paying for costs using that, in my opinion. So that amount each month we target and pay and sell enough just for that. So that's the first part.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just a you might as well just be a hedge fund. I mean, you're just speculating directionally on an asset, right?
Thank you. So I totally agree. And so the excess amount then becomes a bit of a judgment call. And so knock on wood, we've been right so far. In that we hold it if we believe that we have a positive view on Bitcoin, and if we think the Bitcoin prices will probably drop, we sell. So as an example, when Bitcoin was on its way up to the prior highs of the high 60s, we were holding. And then when it declined at 42,000-ish, we decided we're going to sell every Bitcoin that we mine because we think everything's going to get worse, which unfortunately was correct. But fortunately for us, we did it early. As I think most of my peers did it around 20s because they were hodlers. Mm-hmm. And so on its way down, it did that. It bottomed out, I believe, around 13. And then on its way up, when it hit 17, we adopted the current strategy that I just told you about now, where we hold the excess. So from 17 all the way to now, we've been holding all excess Bitcoin as a quote-unquote investment. But I also want to be very careful that, and this leads to my rabbit hole conversation, we're not hodlers. We see it as working capital. So if it's not in US dollar, it's in Bitcoin, just like it, we go back and forth on that. And we will sell the Bitcoin if we need it to fund certain things. And so we have been selling Bitcoin for growth. I've been buying new machines. I recently bought a few batches and I sold Bitcoin to do that. So it's not a married strategy just to hodl. And that is now the rabbit hole I'm going to get into, is we don't believe in hodling. We believe in Bitcoin, but we don't believe in hodling because investors should not be buying us to hodl. You can do that much better and much more efficient on your own. Like, you can have your own cold wallet, which is the best way to do it. You could have it in MicroStrategy's MicroStrategy. There are ETFs that you could buy that are much more cost efficient and isolates the value of Bitcoin on its own. To buy a miner that holds Bitcoin, you're also paying for their G&A, their marketing, their all sorts of things, executive salaries, stuff you don't need to pay for. And if for some reason the mining operation for that investment for some reason does poorly, you're now forced to sell your entire position, including your Bitcoin. Whereas if you had it split between a miner only and a Bitcoin investment only, you could actually just split off the one piece. So there's a massive inefficiency that for some reason the market is still rewarding miners for. And I think that's a legacy impact because it was difficult for investors previously to buy Bitcoin, but now that's not the case. And so they're still rewarding miners to do it. But if you take a step back, and this is my traditional commodity background again, if you look at any other commodity, gold, whatever, no one holds their gold or silver for investment purposes. They sell it because those mature industries, those investors know, if I want gold exposure, I can just buy gold, right? I don't need to buy Barrick just for gold, right? You want it for the leverage, which there's a lot. But anyway, rant over. I'm going to go on forever if I keep talking about this.
No, I love it. I think it's super interesting, kind of the way that you're thinking about everything. And it's just something that, you know, basically people don't really get insight to every day. But when we think about, I want to go back to one of your earlier points about you guys, you know, Gryphon Digital Mining being one of the most efficient crypto miners that is out there publicly traded. What are the factors that actually go into determining efficiency when it comes to mining?
Oh, yeah. It's actually very simple. And I'm glad because generally speaking, simple is better. Math is very simple.
Yeah.
It is number of Bitcoin generated in a month, let's say, if we're doing it monthly, divided by the average hash rate during that month. And so basically speaking, the predictability of a company's revenues is very simple with Bitcoin mining, because the number of Bitcoin I expect to earn is generally going to be my percentage of the global network hash rate. And it historically is generally hit that way. There's some luck involved, but it generally is that. So based on that logic, everyone's expected amount of Bitcoin per hash rate should be the same, because we're all using similar machines. And so we all should be generating the exact similar Bitcoin numbers. But unfortunately, it isn't. And there's a variety of reasons for that. And that's the reason why this is looked at as an operational metric. Because if you're underperforming what you're supposed to get, it's generally because something is going wrong. And let me explain a little bit more. The industry, because it's very retail oriented and very hot, many of the players, and you see this in any hot industry, as you guys probably know, like if you see it in cannabis space, you see it in uranium, you saw it for, you're seeing it in Bitcoin mining, where when the industry takes off, a lot of new entrants come in and their sole real thing is to try to drive up stock prices any way they know how. And so reporting a higher hash rate has been the primary way for companies to be valued. And so many miners stepped in and just grew their hash rate as fast as possible because they would get these gigantic valuations, and then the people doing it sell their stock and away they go, right? They make a lot of money. What some of them have neglected is that they haven't really picked good operations. And so while they're chasing hash rate, they might not quite care on the execution of it. And so they might have set up operations that are less than optimal to run, or made decisions that I wouldn't have made, let's say. For example, Texas.
Like a FOMO market buyer, just going in and just willy-nilly just hitting the buy button.
Yeah, but it's not even a FOMO guy, really. It's more I know what the investors are going to give me value for, so I'm just going to juice this as much as possible, everything else be damned. Right? Maybe not as aggressive as what I just said, but kind of. Sure. And so here's an example. Like Texas, great state, opened its arms wide for Bitcoin mining. We may consider going, but when it first started, we didn't go there. Many of our peers did. And they enjoyed it. But the problem with Texas is twofold. One, it's exceptionally hot. And so machines, if you're air cooling them, will overheat. And in the summer, I know they overheat a lot because we help manage someone else's machines that were there. They overheat a lot. So they're down. Yeah. So you could have a large hash rate deployed, but if it's not running, who cares? The other part too is that the Texas grid is a little weaker than most. And so those miners are often asked to turn off their machines because power is needed elsewhere. And so again, great to have machines there, but if you have no power running them, who cares? And so in by comparison for Griffin, our machines are located in upstate New York in an economic opportunity zone. So cooler climate, we don't turn off that often because of heat. Actually, our curtailments are very light each year annually because it's usually more it gets too cold and we need the power, not it gets too hot. The other situation is it's an economic opportunity zone. So us being in that location is actually good for the area because we're actually promoting the economic development of the deployment of power in that region. And there's very little outside demand that would cause prices to jack up or cause us to need to shift the power away. And so making the right choices and location has helped. So stuff like that goes into how your Bitcoin efficiency number ends up.
What's the current price of mining a Bitcoin after the halving? Because we know that it essentially goes up, right? It goes up every single halving cycle. And I've seen a lot of reports, you know, some people are saying it's 30 or 40,000. I've seen a lot of people, probably the most people, say it's closer to maybe like 50,000 or above that. But I'd love to hear just straight from yourself, because if anyone's going to have a good idea of what a Bitcoin cost, is going to be you after
that. And that's also a really good question, because typically like the market kind of takes a look at the price of mining Bitcoin and it kind of prices that as the floor price. And so people are trying to say, because you're not going to really want to mine if you're mining something and you got to sell it for less than you actually put in to, you know, mine it, right?
Yeah. And that's a very commodity way of looking at it, which is the right way of looking at it, is that's your break-even costs. Like going back to university economics, right? Like in a perfectly competitive environment, your marginal costs and marginal revenues intersect, and it's a break-off. So let me answer in a couple of ways. I can speak for ourselves. Last year, our costs were averaging $18,200. That's pre-halving. So if you do halving, you basically just double it. So theoretically, it's around $36,400 based on last year's metrics, which is us. And we believe we're among one of the lowest cost guys based off of what we see. All the publicly traded miners disclose their costs in some way. So you can always figure it out and basically take their last reports and just double it, because that's theoretically what it would be for their cost to mine. One of the interesting things that I've been looking at lately is there's this website that they take data from Cambridge University that looks at the power usages for Bitcoin miners. And their estimate is actually at 102,000. For average cost to mine Bitcoin right now, which is nuts.
Oh, wow.
But is what their stats show. I suspect, assuming the data is right, is that a lot of the old legacy miners were turned on because Bitcoin prices were very high for a while. We also had runes show up and give us a lot of fees for that as well. And so I think a lot of legacy miners were turned on to take advantage of the fact that there was a much higher than expected price. Like we hit all-time highs before the halving, which is the first time ever we've seen that. And so I think those machines will probably turn off sooner rather than later. I think we go through always a period where everyone's losing, like, sorry, not everyone. Those machines are losing money, but they leave them on anyway because they might as well just in case things get better. And then if they start losing money too long, they start turning off. And so I think there's going to be a lot more machines shutting down. And you see it in the global network hash rate, by the way, is that it touched 800 at one point, and now we're at the fives, right? So a lot of machines have already been turning off, and I think more probably do in order for that number to come down.
Yeah. And is this what they talk about when they FUD the miner death spiral?
possibly. I'm not too familiar with the miner death spiral, so I might need a definition on what that specifically means in this case. Doesn't sound good, though.
Basically, like as the halving occurs and then it becomes these inefficient operations are forced to turn off their miners. And so all of a sudden you have this cascade of, miners, turning off their miners because they're now not making a profit. And then sort of the price of Bitcoin goes down because all the miners are shutting down and, the network isn't secure because there's not enough mines. I guess it's probably, the more I actually define it, and it does sound pretty ludicrous, but it is a narrative that is out there.
Yeah. I personally don't think that's a thing, because miners shutting down shouldn't affect the cost of the price of Bitcoin. They would only shut. It actually is in reverse. A lower price causes miners to shut down, but I don't think it's circular that way, because I don't think what a miner does really impacts the price of Bitcoin. There is always going to be a critical point where there's not enough hash rate, but given that we're at least 500 exahash right now, we have plenty, because when I first started, it was at 100, 200 exahash. So it's not like it's at a critical point. I don't think we're ever going to really be there. The key thing is, it actually is better for guys like us, because as a low cost producer, the more of those other guys who shut off means my proportion of the total pool gets bigger. So I'm actually going to win more Bitcoin. And I've gone through a few halvings, and that's always been the case, where You would think that we would make half as much as before, which mathematically we're supposed to. But because so many other guys turn off, my half ends up really being 0.6, 0.7 instead, because my proportional win rate is a little higher relative to the math. So it always ends up being better to be a low-cost guy, because you'll end up enjoying the fact that other guys are turning off.
Yeah, and that also compounded by, you know, every halving cycle, there's some new innovation that kind of comes out that increases the amount of fees that miners get. And so one of the things I noticed on the first few blocks of the new halving was, it was actually the tripling, because, you know, the fees that were associated with Bitcoin blocks actually tripled, because there were so many fees from inscriptions and ordinals and runes and, you know, all these other layer two platforms that are starting to, you know, come out and really get some scale. And so I think all that's really important, because there does need to be a fee market to, you know, a very robust fee market to develop on Bitcoin over time, as the block reward, or should I say the block subsidy, actually dries up. So how do you kind of think about the calculus there of, you know, switching more of your revenue coming from fees in 2030 and beyond, and currently now just from the subsidy of the actual network?
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. For us, we're super conservative. So the only part that we really model in is the official block reward, which is right now 3.25. We look at fees, the transaction fees, as a very nice bonus. And because it's so volatile, it's very difficult to, you know, plan out a company based off of something so volatile. So we see it as a bonus, and whatever shows. As it becomes a larger and larger contributor to the total payment, which it's now starting to be, which is great, we're probably going to probably run a regression analysis or some type of analysis looking at what the averages are, pick something conservative and start implying that in. But right now for us, we don't really plan for the fees. We always just look at it as a bonus. And I think that's a good way of looking at it, because if my business is still solid with the fact that I'm totally ignoring transaction fees, it's only going to get better with the transaction fees. So that's what we've been doing.
Nice. Yeah, it's a little hidden sweetener. Right. I love it. And one of the things I'm also thinking about is like, okay, so, you know, you're projecting, and you got these, you know, publicly, you know, disclosed SEC filings. How do you model the price of Bitcoin down the line, a year, two, 3 years from now? Because, you know, the block reward is going to get cut in half. And so do you model the price of Bitcoin is at the same price, you know, we're going to be mining in the future at the next halving for, you know, 1.5 or whatever the thing is?
Yeah. So it's interesting. As a former commodity guy, it's garbage in, garbage out. Let me just be fully honest about it. And I'm telling you this as a guy who won a Bloomberg Award for gold predictions. So it is totally garbage in, garbage out. And it's just whatever we end up picking. So, and here's the thing. Anyone who...
What do you mean by that? Garbage in, garbage out.
That's what I'm getting into right now is whatever price you pick, you need to necessarily increase the hash rate as well. So if you're going to increase the global hash rate by X, you're going to increase the global price by X as well, because you're not going to model something where hash rate goes up and gold price goes, or Bitcoin price goes down, because that doesn't make any sense and logically doesn't work anyway, because they're both positively correlated. So if I'm forecasting a different number than what's steady state now, then I naturally would be offsetting it with the price so that it would always work. So that's why I kind of think it's garbage in, garbage out, because if I assume a 10% increase in global hash rate, I'm going to at least assume a 10% increase in Bitcoin price. So I'm going to be okay regardless. So we look at it differently. I look at it as, at what point does this not work? And that's what I tell my team is, what are my break evens on any scenario here? And let's make sure that those numbers are so far out of the question that if we do something, that we're going to be okay. Like, I look at it from that scenario. I'm not necessarily picking a forward price on any of my forecasts, because who knows of which way it goes. What I do know is that we're not going to see 800 exahash and $30,000 Bitcoin. It doesn't work that way, right? They're positively correlated. But what I do need to protect myself is it's at 500 and change now. And because of market weirdness, it drops to 40,000 out of nowhere. I need to make sure that my break even is still below that number. And as I said, we're at theoretically 36. So we are technically okay in that really crazy scenario that possibly could occur. So for us, it's not a what are we forecasting. For us, it is what are our comfortable limits on where, if things start falling apart, how far down can it go before we're really in trouble?
Agreed. You know, do you think that there's any other cryptocurrencies that are worth mining besides Bitcoin?
That's tough. From a commercial standpoint, as a publicly listed company, I don't think there is. Bitcoin is stable, has a large market, and is globally accepted. And frankly, the SEC is okay with it now. as and so there may be others that could emerge. As someone who's represented the first publicly listed Bitcoin miner in the U.S., I do not have any interest in being the first in another one, simply because the SEC definitely makes it hard when you do it. And so I'd rather someone else go over the breach first and follow them if it works. But right now, I don't see it. It might happen, but I do think that Bitcoin will be the daddy for quite a while in the space.
Yeah. Do you think there's any merit to proof of stake? So, you know, you guys are proof of work, yeah. Where you're spinning up all these miners. Ethereum, for the people, you know, at home watching, you know, it used to be proof of work, and then there was the merge, and now it's a proof of stake thing. So where you can go and you could kind of earn interest on your coins. How do you kind of think of this model? Is it a complete Fugazi, or is there a little bit of merit to it?
The logic there is solid, right? I think there are more available points of breach or points of weakness in proof of stake. Although if you have enough critical mass, I don't think it's much of a concern for them either. For a new crypto token that starts, I think proof of stake would be very problematic because you could easily take over based on size. But with Ethereum, it seems to have the necessary critical mass that it can't actually be manipulated, although theoretically you still could. Because when you think of it, it's really just, I think of it in this way, at what point can any blockchain be corrupted? And so for Bitcoin, you need 51% of total network hash rate, which frankly would be impossible because the amount of energy you'd need to do it on your own and somehow trick every miner that you somehow hacked into that you're now controlling it is pretty impossible to do just on the numbers standpoint. Or if you're doing it on your own, the amount of power you would need to do on your own is just insane. So one cannot just build this overnight and quietly without someone noticing. So I think Bitcoin is pretty much impossible because of that. Whereas with proof of stake, you could feasibly get enough large players to work together. And then that's where your fail point is. I think Ethereum is large enough where that can't happen, but it's much easier for that to happen than what I just said for Bitcoin. And I think that's where the difference is, really.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. How has the ETF kind of changed your business or how has the ETF kind of changed the industry from your perspective?
Yeah, it's been great. I think it is a primary driver as to why we enjoyed all-time high Bitcoin prices prior to a halving. I do still believe that the halving naturally forces the price of Bitcoin to double every 6 months. It goes back to the earlier point you gentlemen mentioned where because it gets a cut in half, you know, costs all go up. And if you want to maintain the Bitcoin network, prices have to match. Given that costs go up, you won't have miners otherwise. So it does have to double, at least from a cost standpoint. And pre-halving, I think it was around 4550, right? Which would support 100,000 now, by the way. I kind of lost my train of thought there.
Those are big ideas and those are big numbers. It makes a ton of sense. And I definitely have seen the ETF basically impacting businesses really positively, just from like the psychological standpoint of like, wow, BlackRock now has ETFs, and hold on, I think my Wells Fargo banker or my Merrill Lynch, you know, bankers calling me about it. It like brings a whole nother layer of legitimacy. You know, my dad called me, he's like, hey, Fidelity has a has an ETF now. And so, you know, it's just those kind of things that I think make the market just so much more, warm to crypto and buying miners and bringing that in as part of a portfolio, basically.
Yeah, I think the global adoption aspect of it is huge. And from what I've been hearing, many organizations still haven't even approved it yet. So even though the ETFs is available, right, you still need to pass internal compliance. And I've heard several have not yet done it. They will. And so we might see a secondary rush into Bitcoin mining, ETFs, simply because those investors who couldn't buy it before now can. Mm-hmm. And I think the other impact that many people aren't talking about is how it's affected Bitcoin miners in general. Because as I mentioned earlier, miners before were getting rewarded for holding the Bitcoin. I think a reason why that the Bitcoin miners suffered a little bit, despite the fact that Bitcoin prices were going up really high, was that there was a rotation out from those who wanted them just for the Bitcoin exposure, that they're now just doing the clean one in the ETFs and have moved away from rewarding miners for doing so. So I think there is a bit of a reckoning that's coming for those miners who have been holding it as a HODL strategy, that they're no longer going to get the recognition that they used to get for that. And that's because of the ETFs. Mm.
You know, one of the points that I've seen you bring up here recently is just the position of hedge funds and their short interest regarding Bitcoin. And so I'm kind of just curious, like, what you've seen on that end, and if you can walk us through like the different things that you've found or noticed in regards to that.
Yeah, well, if you look at it, any commodity or any asset, when it has massive price appreciation, because again, Bitcoin started this year in the 20s, 30s, it's now 60s, touching 70s at one point. And so when you see that much appreciation, and then you had the question mark event that causes instability such as the halving, you'll see hedge funds short it, because that historically does cause prices to go back. And we've seen them get rewarded, because look, Bitcoin's at 60,000 now, where it started much higher, or $10,000 more, maybe just a few weeks ago. So it's been working. That being said, I believe a short squeeze can occur simply because, fundamentally speaking, I think Bitcoin prices will trend higher. It's just a matter of when. Historically, as I said, the price of Bitcoin is generally double post-halving anyway. And I think they see this too, but there is always the short-term availability of it being a little too frothy, people no longer buying because of a unique event that causes some risk. And I think that's what we can see in the future. But right now, the shorts are working out for them right now.
Yeah, and that's something that I've noticed too. You know, me and TiVo were just talking about this a few weeks ago, seeing that there is a lot of like hedge fund and institutional side that's not only shorting like Bitcoin itself, but also like crypto related stocks. Their short positions were increasing, especially as Bitcoin broke the all-time highs pre-halving. And it was one of the things that stood out to me. So yeah, I don't know. I just found the whole thing interesting. And you're right, I guess it pays out in the short term, but it sounds like, you know, your position and even my position is that this is probably a short-term short position.
That's why they call them shorts, right? You go short for a short time and you go long for the long time.
That's exactly it. You can't short for the long term. That's a crazy strategy, unless the whole industry for some reason is going under. So I would agree with that. And I do agree. I think miners, I haven't looked at the stats, but I wouldn't be surprised if short interest on miners in general have gone up because of what's happening, right? Like, you're getting your revenues cut in half, and if you're not fully prepared, that's going to suck. And so it makes a good case for a short.
Yeah. And, makes sense. You know, I definitely am curious on your thoughts on MicroStrategy, because people kind of looked at this, you know, back when there was no ETF, like, hey, that's your way to get, you know, spot Bitcoin exposure. Miners started, you know, more miners came out. There's more ways, but do you view them as competition? Do you view them as, you know, a good player in the space? What do you think?
It's a necessary player in the space. And this is coming back from my commodity background, because for every...
Someone was going to do it, right?
Kinross or Barrick, there is a gold ETF and for GLD. And so that is a natural progression. If your space is popular enough, it's going to get this, right? So it's actually a good thing that it exists, because that does legitimize Bitcoin in general to have ETFs or other investment vehicles for Bitcoin itself. And so, if Michael Saylor wasn't doing it, someone else would. And it provides at least a on-ramp for an investor who, hey, I'm interested in Bitcoin. The first thing they usually buy is a Bitcoin ETF, because it's new, it's easy, there's not much risk. But then that's a stepping stone to maybe I should buy a miner, because Griffin mines at 18,200, whereas MicroStrategy is buying Bitcoin at 60,000 right now. There's leverage there. So maybe I should buy that. So it's kind of an on-ramp onto doing more investing in the space in general.
Yeah, makes sense. And Rob, you know, we just want to make sure, you know, that Griffin Digital has, you know, a really bright future ahead. And so where can people kind of stay in touch with what the next steps are? Do you guys have like a public roadmap, or how could people kind of stay in touch and see what's on the road ahead? And maybe you could give us a little glimpse.
Yeah. So they can always follow us, griffindigitalmining.com, plus our Twitter, which is Griffin Mining, can always follow, plus myself as well, which you can find on Twitter. And my PR team has been very great at that, and my IR team as well. But in terms of our roadmap, we have announced it. And so our plans are, we're looking to get to 10 exahash. That is an aspirational goal, because going from one exahash, which is what we are right now, to 10 is quite the jump. But it does show what we're trying to do. There are some companies will be very happy if they only, you know, got 50% more or doubled. Our goal is to aggressively get bigger faster. Our pathway to do so is through first M&A. We are very actively looking around, talking to different companies, mostly private companies that are in the Bitcoin mining space, of course, but they have now entered into the halving, are on the other side of it, and still have old machines, and they don't have the availability or the ability to upgrade those machines because they don't have capital. And so unless you have some deep-pocketed investor in the background willing to give you money, they probably will have a very hard time finding capital to upgrade their machines, because now that there are so many public miners such as ourselves available, most investors would prefer to give us the money because they could sell the stock as opposed to giving it to a private company where they're locked in. And so those guys are now a lot more open-minded into merging or doing business with a pubco that would give them direct access into the market, because the other alternative is to try to list onto the market. And it took us 2 years to do so. They see that. And if they try that, they might miss the whole cycle again. We see a lot of opportunity with private companies that are in an unfortunate position, but that's opportunity for us. And so we're looking to do.
I got one more sure. kind of random question, but hey, you're the guy to be asking this. You know, nuclear, I see, is coming back online across many different places. I mean, how is nuclear energy going to affect your business? And would that drive the costs of mining down? And how do you kind of think about maybe leveraging nuclear?
Yeah, nuclear energy is great. And as you noted, former uranium analyst, I sit on uranium boards. So it is one of the best sources of carbon neutral power, because the actual operation of a nuclear power plant does not generate any carbon. So that's a fantastic thing. And it's one of the low cost ones post building it around. So I welcome it. And I would love to use nuclear for my machines simply because it's a great crossover between my two industries that I'm still involved in. And I have a great perspective on actually pushing that forward. So always interested when someone brings one of those to the table, and would love to do something in that space when it becomes available.
Incredible. Well, hey, Rob, this was awesome. We really enjoyed your time. And I guess, yeah, last question, I kind of like to get a sense from a lot of guests who come on. You know, what's one other company that you want to give a shout out to that you think maybe is flying under the radar, that's maybe even worth another podcast episode? Who really excites you in the industry?
Yeah, well, I actually really like my peers. Again, if they're not there, someone else is going to be. That's just how it is. Sure. And so I do appreciate the innovation that Bit Digital is doing, because they are moving into other things such as AI, and they've done some staking, which is aggressive in the space. I know Sam pretty well. He's a good guy. And I'm cheering them on, because they're not doing entirely Bitcoin mining, but it's looking for other ways to improve shareholder value. And I think that's always very impressive to do.
Awesome. Well, yeah, we'll check out Bit Digital. I just ran a quick Google search. It looks like their ticker is BTBT, and it looks like they're public as well.
They are.
Well, hey, Matt, Rob, this was awesome. And we definitely want to have you back on again, because I got a list of a million other questions I didn't even get to ask you. But we are up on time. I hope you enjoyed. I hope everybody at home listening enjoyed, or maybe you're on your way to work. Hopefully this gave you some entertainment and some info. And everybody go have a great day, and we'll see you back same time, same place next week. Rob, thank you for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me, guys. It was fun.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.